Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Kay, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the class of 2005. Here on the Providence College Podcast, we bring you interesting stories from the Fryer family. This week, we're talking with Karen Cruzan of the class of 1987. Cruzan, who majored in social work at Providence College, spent years as a psychotherapist and as a nonprofit executive. For more than a decade, she has used her skills and passion for organization to help people struggling with hoarding. She is a supervising licensed independent social worker, a certified professional organizer in chronic disorganization, and a certified clinical trauma professional. Twice, Cruzan has been the featured organizer on the TLC show Hoarding, Buried Alive. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It sounds like you've had an innate zeal for organization from a very early age. Can you tell us about some of your earliest memories of organizing?
Yeah, and it's interesting because most professional organizers have stories that go way back of how they were on the career path to be an organizer before they even knew it. So I can remember I used to have this grocery store toy set, and I can remember setting it all up, and I would spend forever getting everything in just the right place and making the store perfect. And then I was done. I had no idea how to play with it after that. That was play for me. I had friends would come over and they'd want to play, dolls that would dress up. And I'd be like, but wait, we have to get everything in the right place first. And they would be, come on, let's just play. I didn't know how to do that. I only knew how to set it up and make it nice.
I'm sure that some of our listeners can identify with that. Just thinking about the term hoarding, many people use it in a very casual, joking way, but it seems like it could be a symptom of mental illness or other problems. What are some of the things that lead people to hoard?
Yeah, there's lots of things that lead people down that path. So it is now recognized as a mental disorder. It has to be properly diagnosed because people can have hoarding behaviors where they do things that seem like hoarding. Doesn't mean they have the full-blown disorder. So there is a 50% genetic correlation. So if you had a hoarding disorder, the likelihood that someone in your family had it would be very high. So depression, physical illness, lots of traumas, grief and loss really set somebody up down a path to have hoarding behaviors. But you also see lots of ways that people think about things. Things like, I might need this someday. It isn't broken. It still has use. I don't want to get rid of it. A protection for the landfill. Sometimes it's part of someone's identity. We see a lot of teachers who end up with chronic disorganization or hoarding because they have a lot of supplies for their classes, and there's so much of their identity that's tied up in being a teacher. And then when they retire, like that part's over and they haven't filled it with something else. And so then it makes it really hard to get rid of all those representations of who they are. And that's what I love about hoarding is people have so many different paths and ways of getting there, but there's a lot of commonality. And it's like solving a puzzle. It's trying to figure out what are the pieces that led someone there and how do you help them get out? Lots of times it's, people get overwhelmed. Attention deficit disorder can be a contributor. It can be very overwhelming when you think about like a hoarded environment. Where do you start? And then how do you get out? And all of that emotion that floods people makes it really hard. And then they get stuck and it gets worse and worse and it becomes this cyclical thing. And a lot of times then you're in this house that's uncomfortable and that doesn't feel good. So you want to feel better. So what do? You go out and you shop. And then you bring more things home. And so you get this like dopamine high from the shopping, right? The thrill of the hunt and the purchase, and that feels really good. And then you bring it home and then you get hit with the reality. And a lot of times what you see, even when you see things on the TV shows, you see items still in bags and they don't get opened. And that's part of that cycle.
I was curious how much experience with scarcity. I think about, we hear stories about our grandparents' generation, saving things when they were living in the Great Depression and not, like, as you mentioned, not being able to throw things away and trying to reuse everything possible because they had experienced this scarcity, or people who had lived in poverty. Is that something that can be a trigger for hoarding behaviors?
The research doesn't support that. We think that For sure, because we know about people who have lived with scarcity, and you see them do some of those kind of hoarding behaviors. But what we know is that when you think about the Great Depression, that was what you had to do to survive, right? You reused candles and plastic bags and aluminum foil and all the supplies. You got every ounce of life out of them that you could, and you saved everything. When the Depression ended, people who didn't have hoarding tendencies went back to life as normal. They stopped doing those things. But the people who were already predisposed and then kind of really entrenched in those beliefs, they maintain those behaviors. And sometimes they pass them on through learned behaviors to their children.
And that's what, when you said there was a genetic predisposition to hoarding behaviors, I was really intrigued by that, because I'm sure there must be research to support this. It wasn't just that if your parents were a hoarder and that's the way you thought, you know, you set up a house, that you would do it yourself. It's not, right. There must be something more. Yeah.
And it's interesting when I look at family, sometimes what you see is if somebody and a parent or both parents are hoarding in the house and then they have more than one child, sometimes you'll see one child has hoarding tendencies, hoarding behaviors, or full-blown hoarding disorder. And sometimes you see another child in the family go the extreme opposite direction, become a minimalist, and they have almost nothing and no attachment to anything, and things go super fast. And so some of that you see as adaptations and responses to a childhood environment.
So many of us, including me, struggle with containing clutter, even if it's not out of control. What are some tips that you suggest to people to help them get started with getting organized?
Yeah, one of the things that's really helpful, and I use this myself, is I plan events, or I like to, you know, make sure I have people coming over to my house, because that's when all the cleaning happens, right? It's really easy and you get in your groove and like, nobody sees it. You kind of turn your brain off to it. But when you have someone coming over, you're going to clean, you're going to get things put away. And so some of that just helps you with the day-to-day maintenance so you don't get behind. Other simple things to do are you can have like a bag in your bedroom. And when you put something on in the morning, if you don't like it and you're going to change it, is it goes right into the donation bag. It doesn't go back in the closet because it's not going to look better another day. So it's kind of that streamline, just make it go away and not add more layers to your process. The other thing I always recommend to my clients is you have to make it fun, because most people, I'm an anomaly, I like organizing. Most people don't. I hate cleaning. So you have to make those kinds of things fun. So it's figuring out a way, whether it's coming up with a game, you know, especially with kids, right? How much can you put away in 5 minutes? Can you put on like some music and then dance while you're organizing or getting things back in their homes? The other idea is to do a one in, one out. So anytime you bring something into your house, you think, okay, if I'm going to buy this, you know, dress, something else has to leave from my closet so that I'm not buying more hangers. I'm not buying more dressers to put things in. I'm going to kind of keep at the level that I am.
So I definitely have been motivated in the past for cleaning up for guests personally. But you know, the pandemic really threw a wrench into that motivation. So I'm curious if you could tell us, or if you've seen with your own clients, how the pandemic and everything surrounding it has impacted chronic disorganization and hoarding behavior.
Yeah, it's been really interesting because I'm connected to organizers around the country, and to hear how we all pivoted in different ways and how our clients reacted was really fascinating to me. So because I work with mostly severely disorganized or hoarding clients, they vanished. They did not want to go to virtual organizing sessions. We weren't doing in-home because it wasn't safe. And they sort of just disappeared from me, where other organizers offered visual sessions just like I did, and their businesses thrived. They got new clients. So there were people for sure who are spending more time in their homes. And when you're in it, you see more things, right? You have to work at home. More people are there. You kind of notice how your systems and processes aren't working or how you have too much stuff. And so a lot of people got more organized. And I think the people on the extreme clutter and the hoarding end struggled a lot more because they had to be in their houses. And that's where the emotions are overwhelming to them and they weren't able to make changes. My guess is from at least my client base that their depression grew and their anxiety grew and they didn't make progress.
Yeah, I could see how for some people who weren't organized, this is just like piling on, right? Mm-hmm. Like having to stay inside the house. But then other people who were normally organized might have gotten, you know, the stress and anxiety may have affected the normal processes that they're right. able to deal with. Definitely a range. So Karen, in our modern lives, clutter can take very many different forms. Can you share any strategies for dealing with digital clutter? I'm thinking about the 15 photos that you have to take to get one usable photo of your children, both looking the same way with their eyes open, or the number of tabs open in your browser, for example.
Right. And digital organizing isn't my specialty, but it's a lot of the same similar concepts, right? So if you had a stack of photos, you would want to weed out the ones that aren't good, right? Somebody's eyes are closed. It's just a tree. It's an accidental click. And I see those physical photos that people still have. And you want to be able to weed those out and get rid of them. And I think digitally with photos, it's kind of the same thing. It's first getting rid of the ones that aren't worth looking at, that they don't make you happy to see. And then it's trying to arrange them in a way that you can find them. And luckily, computers have changed so much that it's much easier to search for things. So the use of folders and having to have really good digital organizing systems is a little less, as long as you name it something and you can retrieve things a lot that way. And it's funny because for me, like a lot of times I help people let things go by asking them if a picture of it will suffice, because sometimes it's a memory and they want to hang on to that part. So I have them take a picture and knowing that, you know, I don't know their digital clutter life, but I want them to have a physical environment that's safe and clutter free.
Could you tell us about your experience being on Hoarding Buried Alive? What was it like to be the featured organizer there?
It was fascinating. So I was terrified, of course, because I'm an introvert and having, you know, the mic packs on and cameras and producers. The thing that was shocking to me is how much more staged it was than I thought it would be. So it was stand here, do this. It was kind of the producers running the show in terms of they had interviews with the homeowner first, and kind of they knew the hot buttons. They knew things that would make interesting TV. And so sometimes, like in one of the shows I did, they would be handing a family member something from off screen to send to me to talk to a client about, because they knew that there was emotion or it was a story that was going to be interesting. But I didn't know that. And so I kind of, you know, sometimes you get hit with stuff on camera and you have no idea what's coming because it makes better TV. Then the other episode I did was really hard because it seemed like the agenda was to ramp up the tension. And that was really hard as a therapist to watch producers trying to initiate conflict. But it was a good learning experience. I mean, it was definitely interesting to see what goes on behind the scenes.
You brought up something that made me want to ask about, you know, families. I'd imagine that some of the clients you work with have family members who are living with people who do not have hoarding tendencies or do hoarding behaviors. How do you work through that? And how can we apply that in a less severe situation when mm-hmm. you know, you and your spouse disagree on how to organize things?
Yeah. And it is really hard. I get a lot of calls from family members who are concerned about somebody either that they're living with or a parent from afar. And it is really challenging. And on the kind of a lower end scale, when there are people in the family that disagree, sometimes it can be helpful to have, like everybody needs their own space to do whatever they want. So in my house, when my daughter was young, her room was her place. There were very few rules other than, you know, she couldn't have food in her room, things that, you know, wouldn't bring bugs or yuck, too much ick for my taste. But her, then she could do whatever she wanted with it. And I think we all need that space. And so my office is that way. If I want it to be perfectly organized, I can have it that way and I can put everything back exactly where it goes and I know where it is, but I don't have to hold anybody else to that standard. It's the shared spaces where there's lots of dialogue and compromise and trying to figure out a way to make it work for both people. And it can be challenging because if one person is very visual and they need to see everything, it's kind of an out of sight, out of mind person, they're going to want things out on counters and they don't like things behind cabinets because they might as well not exist. Where for another person, it creates a lot of stress. And it's challenging to find those solutions. So sometimes it's like, can you take off cabinet doors? So it's in a cabinet, but the person can see it.
Or replace them with glass doors, right? So you could see inside.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah, something away. Or, right, some kind of representation so that both people's needs are met.
And you also mentioned kids. And sometimes I think to myself, my house would be really clean if I didn't have two lovely humans that I love very much sabotaging all of my efforts on a regular basis.
Yep.
how do you approach this? What are recommendations you have for parents and families?
Yeah, some of it is, you know, just like you said, you know, you love your kids and they do, they kind of sabotage, not intentionally. And it's knowing that that's not a forever thing that, you know, especially when kids are really little, like the toys are huge, right? And you can't wait for the huge toys to go away. And then the next thing you have is all these little things that you're stepping on and tripping over. And that's not necessarily any better, but you wouldn't trade it. And then the other piece, I think, is you think about, you really want to teach your kids about how to organize things. And so it's about making it as simple for them as you can. So everything has a home, or you have times like at the end of the day, you make sure that they're not super tired and you, okay, everything goes away at the end of the day, or you could do it in the morning. Like there's no magic to the end of the day other than it makes us feel better, but you want to start ingraining some of those skills to put it in, you know, even a big basket. It doesn't have to be organized, just needs to be out of sight, and get kids in that habit. And then even that for them, the one in, one out, because toys and everything just keeps coming in, and you want to get them trained that, you know, space is finite. You don't have room for everything.
So in addition to the various hoarding shows that are out there, I think the most prominent pop culture connection to clutter and organization, I think we've all discussed in recent years, is Marie Kondo. What do you think to her about her approach to stuff?
I think a lot of people really like it. So when I think about her approach and my clientele, it's a really bad match. So I like the fact that she has people being intentional. So thinking about what they want and what they value, how they see their lives. I'm not crazy about the word joy because I have lots of things in my house that don't bring me joy, but I'm still keeping them. My trash can is a perfect example. No joy. Still going to keep it. And I don't like the assigning emotion to every item because I think it sets people up to only see something's value as how it makes you feel. And that worries me a little bit in terms of kind of that hoarding tendency that you add a layer of attachment. The other thing that I get where she's headed, but I can't even imagine it is, you know, when she has you get all of your clothes out, all of them. So I would be so overwhelmed. Like, I don't have a ton of clothes, but if I got all of my clothes out at one time, my brain would be shot. I would be flooded with information and emotion. I'd be done. And then she wants you to make decisions and go through things. And I just can't even imagine that level of stress. But I like the idea of that if you could tone it down, like, let's just get out, long sleeves tops, or genes or some kind of subcategory. You don't need to get everything out at one time. So I think there's good and bad. I think she's got a base of clients that really works for. But I think there's a whole segment of people struggling with clutter that it's just too much.
Too many decisions. I feel like there's also a level of privilege isn't the right word, but the concept, like, if you need it again, you can always acquire it. You can always buy it again. It's like, well, maybe mm-hmm. some people can't, you know, that.
Exactly.
I think a lot of people.
Yeah. And you want to be able to use that. Yeah. For small things. Right. So, you know, small inexpensive things, but for other people, it's like, well, why do I want to then throw that back out into the world? And it's, you know, so much consumerism that I think that doesn't sit well with a lot of people.
Tell us about your path to this career. How did you go from your social work major at PC to professional organizing? And how are you using those social work skills as well as your psychotherapy skills as an organizer?
So when I left PC with my social work degree, I got my master's in social work because I wanted to be a therapist. So I started to do that and worked with kids and families in the inner city. And that was very stressful, really hard work. And I thought, well, if I get out of the public system and I go into private practice, everything will be better. So I did that. And then it seemed like not such a great match for where I was in my life. It was still really hard to handle all the pain and the suffering that people were bringing in. But I found I liked kind of the paperwork end of it, which is really strange. So then I went into the insurance industry and did the managed care end. So providers would be calling me for authorization, like for hospital stays, those kinds of things. So I got into that end of it. And then I worked for a nonprofit and then became the CEO of that to use public dollars to help kids and families. And so I always kind of had my foot in that mental health thing, but got out of the psychotherapy, and that was great for a really long time. And then, but something was kind of missing. And then I remember one day sitting watching the Today Show, and there was a segment in January, it was Get Organized Month, and there was an organizer on, and it got my attention. And I thought, are you kidding me? Like, that's a job. People pay you to do that. I thought that was the greatest thing I'd ever heard. And so it kind of floated in the background for a while. And then when my mom got dementia, she couldn't remember what she already had. And when she went to the store, she'd buy more. And so the house started to get a little full. And so I remember looking for things and then cleaned out the entire pantry, got rid of a bunch of things, reorganized it. And then that idea of being an organizer popped in, and I thought, well, there's no time like this to try it out. And so I started a business, kept a part-time job to pay the bills, and then I thought, excellent, now I'm finally out of the mental health world. And then my very first client, she had some behaviors that I knew were tied to mental health, and that drew me back in. Then we started a colleague of mine, we started a psychotherapy group for people struggling with chronic disorganization and hoarding. And then I had a lot of my organizing clients say, can you be my therapist too? And so that pulled me back in. I thought, this will be okay, because then I can pick and choose my therapy clients and really not be so broad that I get burned out again. And so now I'm doing both. And when the pandemic hit, my organizing went away. I did almost all therapy during that time. And now my organizing clients are starting to come back. And so I've got kind of a 50-50 split.
What brought you to Providence College? I feel like we're going backwards in your timeline here. What brought you to Providence College? And are there things, experiences, or classes or professors that you still call upon today in your work?
So when I was looking at colleges, you know, there were obviously a lot of factors, but one of the deciding ones for me was my brother went to Providence College and he was a senior, and it felt like a little bit extra safe to have somebody there that I could count on, because I was really shy and kind of terrified of going off to college, and it was nice to have him there. And there is one professor, I wish I could remember his name. He has stuck with me. The social work department stuck with me the most. There was a professor who taught stress, and he always talked about the three P's of stress management, and that stuck with me forever. It was partialize, prioritize, and postpone. So it'd be like breaking things down, which is partialize, prioritize, figuring out what's most important. And then postpone was deciding like what you could not do right now. And that I use all the time. I think that's brilliant. And then a lot of the social work classes that I had where it was kind of learning how to be a therapist, learning how to work with people and connecting to the other people in the program. I think our department started out with 13 social work majors. And by the time I graduated, there were 7. Some people opted out. But I think the department was really strong about saying, are you sure this is really what you want to do? And so by the end, the 7 of us were pretty tight. And yeah, it was a great experience.
Well, Karen, it's been lovely talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been great to be here.
Subscribe to the Providence College podcast in all the usual places, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, as well as your smart speaker. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.